Welcome to the Deep Dive.
Hello. Today we're really getting into something pretty fundamental to working life.
Yeah, professional identity. But not just, you know, having one. We're looking at how it's actively constructed.
And controlled. Sometimes even, well, weaponized.
Uh-huh.
Especially now with all this information overload, these organizational pressures.
Right. We've pulled together some fascinating sources, particularly looking at project management and the construction industry.
And our mission, really, is to get past the job titles.
Wow.
We want to look at the actual mechanics, how identity, language, what we call discourse, how that meshes with the tools, the systems that organizations use. It's not just about controlling what people do.
It's about controlling how they think.
Exactly.
We want to give you a kind of shortcut here, a way to understand why some company cultures seem so resistant to change, even when things aren't working.
Yeah, and by the end of this, you should have a clearer picture of those often subtle mechanisms that keep those patterns locked in.
And how that affects individual careers, but also the whole organization, especially when, you know, big changes are needed. Okay, so let's start with the basics, defining the field. Our sources point out something important, the difference between just an occupation and a real profession.
It's not a black and white thing. It's more a matter of degree, really.
And historically, this idea of professionalization, it's about groups trying to achieve status, right?
Absolutely. It's about creating closure, defining who's in and who's out to protect their turf, gain legitimacy, control the market. It's like building a fence around the job.
But things are getting more complicated now. Identity isn't just one single job title anymore.
Oh, definitely not. People are weaving together multiple roles, sometimes seemingly quite different ones, into a single professional identity.
Our sources talk about things like holism and augmentation.
Right. Those terms describe people who manage multiple identities. Maybe they're a life coach and a healer and a certified yoga teacher.
Mm.
And they don't see these as separate gigs. For them, it's integrated. Complementary. It shows high cognitive complexity, actually.
Can you give us an example? Like, how does that look in practice?
Well, there's this person, Kelly, mentioned in the sources. She created her own wellness programs, deliberately mixing mind, body, spirit stuff.
Okay.
Or think about a pastor who also teaches theology, Bible study, but also karate and yoga.
That's quite a mix.
It is. But for this pastor, being a yoga teacher was just part of helping people develop a full spectrum practice. The roles actually reinforced each other in their view.
Crucially, though, these identities aren't just personal projects. They're built and maintained through language.
Yes, that's where professional discourse comes in. All the text, the talk, the jargon that shapes roles and defines who controls what.
And this control works on different levels. Big D and little D, the sources say.
Exactly. Professionalism itself has become a kind of big D discourse. It's packed with ideology, occupational values, and organizations often use it, maybe unconsciously sometimes, as a disciplinary tool. You see it in internal marketing slogans, mission statements.
So the big D is like the dominant cultural assumption, the worldview.
Precisely. It's why an idea like cops are brave just gets accepted within that world. It fits the framework.
But if you said cops are like physicists.
Huh? Yeah, that just wouldn't fly. It clashes completely with the established big D discourse of law enforcement.
Okay, so that's the big picture ideology. What about the little d? How does that control work day to day?
That's the subtle stuff, the socialization on the ground. Think about trainee journalists learning the ropes.
Right.
They don't just get a handbook saying, write this, not that. They learn in story meetings where certain ideas, undesirable ones, just get quietly, or maybe not so quietly, eliminated.
Ah, so it's the practice, the interaction, that reinforces the boundaries.
Exactly. That localized linguistic control shapes behavior way more effectively than any formal policy.
Okay, let's make this concrete. Let's talk about this case study, the big construction company, Alpha.
Yes, Alpha. A really rich example. What the research found there was this incredibly strong, uniform, collective identity. It didn't matter if you were a site manager or an executive.
Everyone identified the same way.
Pretty much. It all centered on the craft, the idea of being a construction worker.
Defined by.
Very practical traits. They saw themselves as doers,
yeah.
Hands-on people. And the most common description, problem solvers. They'd literally say, we just solve the problems.
And this identity wasn't just talk. It was baked into how the company worked through something called path dependency.
Absolutely. There was this rigid, established norm for career progression. You almost never saw managers hired from outside construction.
Kind of come up through the ranks.
You had to. to get legitimacy, to get promoted, you had to have started out working the mud on construction sites, as they put it, for years.
So the company's history basically dictated its future leadership.
That's path dependency in a nutshell.
But hang on, being a problem solver sounds good, right? Practical, gets things done. How does that become a trap, a strategic weakness?
That's the paradox, isn't it? It becomes a trap because the identity is constantly reinforcing itself. There's this concept, adaptive expectation effects.
Meaning
people adopt certain behaviors because they expect everyone else to behave that way. There's this constant signaling, this performance of belonging.
To avoid being seen as an outsider.
Exactly. So if the norm is to jump into fixing immediate problems and you try to step back and think strategically, well, you're not conforming. You stick out.
So it's not just groupthink. It's actively performing the role. A manager might stay late tackling a crisis, not just because it needs doing, but because that's how commitment is judged.
Precisely. You have to be seen doing, seen solving, and the strategic cost is massive. Because this intense focus on immediate practical fixes means the whole organization sees change as reactive, discontinuous. They're not planning ahead.
They're just putting out fires.
Constantly extinguishing fires, as the research puts it. One manager used a great metaphor. He said, alpha plays table tennis. Then we play backspin balls. We play defensive.
I'm always reacting, never setting the pace.
Never anticipating, always on the back foot.
Okay, so you have this deeply entrenched identity. What happens when new ideas or new people challenge it? The sources talk about outsiders and outsiders within.
Right. The classic outsiders in the alpha case were external consultants. They were brought in to introduce new strategy models.
And how did that go down?
Predictably, maybe. The studies observed real resistance. Managers would interrupt the consultants constantly.
Questioning the theory.
Yeah, questioning the relevance of anything abstract. They kept demanding the consultants alphify the material, make it sound more practical, more like them.
Even down to the language used.
Oh, yes. They complained about using formal English terms, preferring their own internal jargon. It's all about boundary work.
Reinforcing the U.S. versus them.
Exactly. Positioning themselves as a bit special, emphasizing the practical doing side, and actively resisting anything that smacked of long-term abstract strategy. It just didn't fit the construction worker mold.
Okay, that's dealing with external threats. But what about the outsiders within? These were people hired by Alpha for strategic roles, right? But without the site background.
Yes, and this is where it gets really problematic. These were people hired specifically for their strategic competence, the very thing the company arguably needed.
But the identity got in the way.
Completely. Their competence was constantly undermined. Their legitimacy was always questioned because they hadn't worked the mud. One manager literally said, I have so many times been told that to get somewhere in Alpha, I would need to go out and work on the construction sites for a time.
Wow. So the organization hires the expertise it needs.
And then tells them they aren't credible because they don't fit the dominant ground-level identity. It refused to see the value they brought.
That's the ultimate strategic blind spot, isn't it? The system actively marginalizes the resources it needs to adapt purely to protect the existing identity.
It reinforces its own limitations. A perfect example of how collective identity can hinder progress.
So if identity is creating these internal roadblocks, what about the actual tools people use, the physical stuff? Does that also play a role in control?
Absolutely. We need to shift focus a bit here, away from just human interactions, and look at the objects, specifically that very mundane thing, the project file.
The binder or the shared drive folder, I'd
say. Exactly. The formalized project file used in construction project management. It seems simple, but the sources use ideas from Science and Technology Studies, STS, to unpack it. And they argue this file isn't just one thing. It's kind of three different concepts, three different power structures, all wrapped up in one object.
Okay, intriguing. What's the first way to see the file?
First, it functions as an immutable mobile. Think of it like a standardized ruler or template.
Immutable, meaning unchanging. Mobile, meaning it travels.
Precisely. It allows information to be gathered consistently across different sites and projects and then travel, unchanged, up the hierarchy, like a quality assurance audit form.
So it lets executives compare apples to apples.
Right. It lets them aggregate data, speak for the whole organization, and exert that top-down hierarchical power. Junior staff have to use the standard forms. It stabilizes knowledge, like the printing press did.
Okay, so it enforces standards. But surely things aren't that rigid on a real construction site. There has to be some flexibility.
There does. And that brings us to the second concept. The file as a boundary object.
A boundary object, as something that connects different groups.
Exactly. Yeah. It has to be flexible enough to work for different communities. The engineers on site, the accountants back at HQ, the safety inspectors, each group might use or interpret parts of it slightly differently.
So it acts as a translator between these different worlds.
It mediates between them. But there's a key caveat. While it might be flexible locally, the file often has stronger, more fixed meanings globally up in the boardroom than it does for the engineer on the ground. The HQ view often overrides the local adaptation.
Okay, so it's a standardizer, immutable mobile, and a flexible translator, boundary object. That seems almost contradictory. What's the third perspective?
This is the most nuanced take.
Yeah.
The sources suggest the project file is best understood as a blank figure.
A blank figure. What does that mean?
It means its real power lies in its incompleteness, its ambiguity. The actual material form is often underdetermined.
Like pages left blank, missing instructions.
Exactly. Blank sections, maybe guidance notes that were never written or are vaguely worded. This isn't necessarily a mistake. It's functional.
Functional blankness. How does that help?
Because it allows the file to accommodate the messy reality on the ground. It lets the file be, in a way, indifferent to all the local variations and workarounds. It manages to enact organizational order. Yes, you still have to fill in the form, submit the report, but it also allows for local disorder, for adaptation, for change, for getting the job done despite the rules.
Ah, so the gaps provide the wiggle room needed to actually function.
Precisely. It's not just reflecting policy. It's this ongoing reservoir of possibilities, as one source puts it. Enough structure for control, enough blankness for local reality.
Let's loop back now to the people caught in these systems. This trend towards projectification, everything becoming a temporary project, it's putting immense pressure on professionals, isn't it?
Mm.
Especially time pressure.
Oh, absolutely. Severe temporal pressures. The sources really highlight this in project work. They identify four main types.
Okay, what are they?
First, there's career insecurity. It's driven by the nature of project work, fixed-term contracts, constantly moving on. And your reputation hangs entirely on whether your last project was judged a success or failure, often retrospectively.
Stressful. What's second?
Work intensification. Just relentless pressure from ambitious deadlines, often coupled with not enough resources. It demands constant, heroic problem-solving.
Firefighting again. Not planning.
Exactly. It rewards reacting under pressure, not anticipating problems. Third, the obvious one, work-life imbalance.
Right.
Often sustained by this sort of masculine norm, where working crazy long hours, being highly visible, is seen as a sign of commitment and excellence. It leads to burnout, high stress.
And the fourth pressure.
Work standardization and control. Those remote standardized project controls we just talked about, the project files, the reporting systems, they often lead to frustration, a feeling of lost autonomy, and just more overwork. It's a bureaucratic iron cage, but applied to project work.
It sounds like an environment that just grinds people down. But here's the kicker. Doesn't the whole idea of professionalism in project management, doesn't that actually make things worse?
That's the really critical and perhaps counterintuitive finding. It absolutely seems to. If you look at the professional discourses within construction project management, you see two main strands.
Okay.
There's the formal, rational, normative discourse. This is the stuff in the textbooks, the Iron Triangle, time, cost, quality, the project lifecycle model.
It's the official way things are supposed to work.
Right. But by institutionalizing these rigid controls, metrics, and intense surveillance, this discourse actually amplifies the time pressure. It codifies the squeeze.
And the other discourse?
That's the informal, socially disciplined one. This is about professional pride, the camaraderie on site, the humor, the war stories.
And it's more positive.
It can feel that way, but it functions to normalize an addiction to the pressure. It creates the expectation that real professionals thrive on the chaos, meet impossible deadlines by working weekends, put in 50-plus hours a week. It becomes part of the identity.
So doing that isn't seen as unsustainable. It's seen as committed professional.
Exactly. And this leads to a massive critical gap, the sources point out.
Which is?
Professional bodies talk a lot about social responsibility, sustainability, ethics, anti-corruption, health and safety, all important things. But across both the formal and informal discourses, there's an almost complete silence, an erasure of the negative impact of these temporal pressures on the actual well-being of the professionals themselves.
So the professionalization effort, rather than protecting workers from the demands of this fast-paced, globalized, capitalist way of working,
it ends up reinforcing it. The very identity of being professional disciplines the worker into accepting, even embracing, the intensification and the pressure. Hashtag tag tag outro.
So pulling this all together, what this deep dive really seems to show is that professional identity, even one that sounds positive and collaborative on the surface, like the construction worker or problem solver, it can become this really powerful self-locking mechanism. It not only resists necessary change and strategic thinking, but it also directly contributes to worker stress, burnout, this kind of professional malaise.
Yeah, the analysis starkly highlights how the professionalization push in areas like project management seems to have made resisting the relentless time pressure seem, well, unprofessional. It's baked into the identity. So given that kind of lock-in, here's something to think about. What kind of organizational change or maybe even material change, think about those project files, what would actually be needed? Beyond just swapping out the managers, what would it take to make it professionally legitimate for you in your own work to actually challenge the nonstop temporal demands, the constant pressure? That's the deeper structural question we'll leave you with.